We said goodbye to Poland, Belgium, Italy, and to the brilliant story of Iceland. While penalty kicks came into play, we saw some quality football with tactical systems in general outweighing the brilliance of individual performances. Hello and welcome to this July 3rd edition of the Eurocopa podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for joining us. In order to review the four games in the European Championship quarterfinals and preview the midweek semifinals, I am joined by Robert Hay, Karthik Krishnayar, and Kristen Henoch will be joining us very soon. Gentlemen, welcome. Karthik, Robert, let's get started with the Poland-Portugal game. It ended in a draw, went to PKs, and in general, it had some similarities to the Portugal-Croatia game, the round of 16 game. A little more exciting than that. And Karthik, it started with Renato Sanchez started this game, and one of the observations you had made was that when I asked you why he didn't start, you rightly pointed out that midfield might lose a little bit of its structure. And you were right, because the first Lewandowski goal did come from a ball played into just that kind of area. And at that point, I actually thought Poland took the foot off the pedal after that a little bit.
Yeah, I was real disappointed. I thought they were going to really put Portugal to the sword with Sanchez kind of having this free role or this roaming role or what appeared to be a free and roaming role. Who knows if that's what Santos had intended when he opted to start him. João Moutinho keeps the shape much better, but has not had a good tournament, right? So We talked about that in the previous show. But I was very disappointed that Poland didn't push on from there, created a couple more chances in the first half while Portugal were wobbly. As Portugal found themselves in the game and got their feet settled, then they ended up getting that goal back, obviously, and then were the better team for much of the game.
Definitely, I thought so too. And Robert, we'll stick with the Sanchez thing, because at this point, we're talking about a player who's still 18, 19 years old. But in a game that had the likes of Lewandowski, Cristiano Ronaldo, Nani, Ricardo Quaresma, etc., etc., it really was Renato Sanchez that took away all the headlines with his overall play, his goal, as well as the PK he scored in the shootout.
Yeah, in a tournament that's seen some great goals, that was another great one by him. So I think that's the first thing that gets attention here, his goal to tie up the match. The other thing is, I think it gave a little bit, to kind of echo what Karthik said, it helped a little bit with the Portugal's tactics. You know, it gave him, he interacted well with Nani and Ronaldo when he needed to, and just gave some fresh legs, I think, to this team. So I think it was a good time to start and a good use of his playing. Would this have been the same way if we would have played earlier? Probably not. So I think it's a good timing. It makes all the difference in these tournaments.
You know what he reminds me, Karthik, of Renato Sanchez, that is? He reminds me, and you'll have to hear me out before you laugh, is Anderson, the Brazilian. When Anderson was first signed by United, he was 18 years old, was an attacking player, kind of looked, even had the same physical attributes that Renato Sanchez does. They about have the same height, play the similar position. They both drive from midfield, try to link up the midfield and the forward line. And then the reason I brought this up is in his very first game, Anderson came up against Gerrard because United played Liverpool. And we're talking peak Gerrard here, Gerrard at his best. And Anderson was by far the best midfielder that day. So I guess from that perspective, the big challenge for a player like Renato Sanchez, who really has the world at his feet, is to make sure that he goes the Pogba route and not the Anderson route, because the talent is there, the ability is there, and he has to make sure he stays injury-free and stays out of off-field problems.
Yeah, I think Anderson for a time was actually a pretty effective player.
Yeah,
particularly in a United team that had a lot of talent, had a good midfield, and he was able to rotate through, and Ferguson was able to use him in certain spots against certain opposition to great effect. Then he just completely tailed off, as did a number of the players that were signed in that period by Manchester United.
Yeah.
So he was far from alone in that category. I mean, I think of the Silva twins and Nani, and even if you want to make this case, guys like Johnny Evans and Darren Fletcher, who really kind of tailed off around the same time as effective players. But I think Sanchez is a guy that we don't want to see get too hyped now at this age. He's going to Bayern. That created enough hype. And then I see Bayern fans saying, well, with him in our midfield, we're going to win the Champions League. He's still a teenager. He's still a guy you can't rely on game in and game out. And this is the problem with international tournaments. It's such a small sample size. And we talk about the small sample size and few data points over and over again when we talk about international football and contrast it with the grind that is the Premier League or the Bundesliga or Serie A or whatever league you fancy, that it is much easier for players who are 16, 17, 18, I think, to have a run of maybe not 16, but 17, 18, 19, to have a run of games where they're very effective in an international tournament, which is kind of a bang, bang, bang thing, rather than to show and develop the type of consistency they need to be effective footballers at the club level over a long period of time. So my fear now with Renato Sanches is he's getting so hyped off of this Euro tournament, off of his last season and signing with Bayern before the tournament, that we could be in a situation where we've overhyped another youngster and he never reaches the level we thought he would reach. And I look at Bayern as a club that has had a lot of guys that are young players that are very good at 18 or 19 that sometimes aren't so good at 25 or 26. And Shaqiri is an example of a player like that right now, who tailed off, was very good at 19 and 20 at Bayern. And now at Stoke City, he's just kind of very hit or miss. And I think he's only 23 or 24 now.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's a good shout with Shaqiri. I think a lot of those players that went to Barcelona at that time, Afellay, I mean, basically the current Stoke City forward line can be argued to be that way. Robert, let's talk about Cristiano, because in this game, we've been looking forward to watching these players like Cristiano and Lewandowski. And in this game, we saw Lewandowski actually have a better game overall. And interestingly, it felt like Cristiano kind of struggled throughout the game.
Yep. Welcome to the tournament, Robert Lewandowski. We've been mentioning that you've been gone, and lo and behold, in the first few minutes, you make your mark. Probably could have had a few more chances. I thought that Poland could have done a little bit more with some of the space in the midfield, but it was not to be, at least during regular run of play. Cristiano, his struggles have been throughout this tournament, whether it's just finally, legs catching up to him a little bit, or the shape of Portugal's play, or the opponents. I mean, he hasn't been like the pedestal we put it on. That being said, he has the opportunity, with at least in this next game and possibly a game after, to kind of cement his legacy. Whereas if he were to score a key goal, make a key play, convert another penalty, something like that, a lot of these criticisms will go away, and really his lack of form that we've seen in this tournament so far becomes a moot point. And what's remembered is the success that this Portugal team has.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, though, I find it quite interesting.
Welcome, Chris.
That Robert makes... I think it's interesting that Robert makes that point about Ronaldo needing that big moment. I felt he kind of did that against Hungary. Maybe I'm like completely alone in that. In thinking that there was a moment where he did kind of drag them back. And I have been fortunate enough this month to kind of sit and watch Lionel Messi endure a similar situation of being that talismanic figure for a country. The difference being that Portugal, as a nation, I think unanimously accepts and adores Ronaldo, whereas it's not the same with Argentina and Messi. It actually seems it's the inverse for Ronaldo, in the sense that the wider world is not so willing to bestow praise on him and elevate him as this world talent. When actually, I think Portugal has talent, definitely. And I think in this game, we saw it with Renato Sanches. I think he showed why Bayern Munich were convinced to pay the money they did after what has been, I think, pretty much an 8-month professional career at this stage. And yet, there's still this kind of, if he doesn't do something huge, then it's seen as a failure on his part individually. And it's a weird situation in the sense that I can't think of many other teams that have been in this tournament where we've evaluated them as a team and then this one individual and how they did relative to that team so consistently.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. I think even as a United supporter, I have to say that a lot of it is the way Cristiano conducts himself. I know that that doesn't reflect on our analysis, because we should be able to look past that. But when you see him, throw his hands up in the air when a pass doesn't come his way, or complain about a pass not coming his way, or complain that someone else took a shot that he himself would have taken, it doesn't help that perception of him. But it is a good point, because we talk about Cristiano in all these negative ways, but he's two games away from doing what the legends of Portuguese football, Figo and Eusebio, couldn't do, which is win a European championship. So your point is well taken. And I'm not sure where I stand on Cristiano because of that.
And I mean, this is the thing. We look at one of his defining moments as a youngster. It was losing the European championships on home soil to Greece, which
right.
was a game they were heavily favourites in. Even just kind of his situation, I do feel there has come a point now where he has almost started to buy into the narrative of, I have to do something big. I have to stand out. I'm constantly trying to stay on pace with Lionel Messi. And it does come through in this kind of very individualistic approach he seems to have to the game at times. And I think it can come at a detriment to Portugal. The problem being that I'd argue since maybe Pauleta and Nuno Gomes retired, you haven't really seen a striker come to the fore and think, yep, that's the man. Hugo Almeida had moments, Helder Postiga had moments, but he's the closest they've got now to that kind of striker. And even that has kind of been through the lucky element of him changing himself at club level from a winger to a forward.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Guys, we will get to previewing the Portugal versus Belgium game. Portugal versus the Wales game, as well as reviewing the Wales-Belgium game. But before we do that, let me really quickly tell you about our sponsor, SeatGeek. So the International Champions Cup is coming up, and it's something that I'm looking forward to personally. I was able to go to see the Manchester United versus Real Madrid at the Big House. I saw United versus PSG last year. So it holds a big place in my heart. And there are lots of games you can choose from. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and just the other day I pulled it up to look for tickets for the Liverpool versus Chelsea game at Rose Bowl in Pasadena. It's going to be a new Chelsea under Conte, and it would be looking at this game to gauge where these players are against a similarly well-drilled Liverpool side under Klopp. So in case you're wondering how you can go and get these tickets, let me let you know that the best thing about all this is that our listeners, our World Soccer Talk listeners, get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. How do you do that? Well, in order to get your $20 rebate, you would download the SeatGeek app, you would go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. You would enter promo code WSTPOD, and SeatGeek would send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So go ahead, download the SeatGeek app, and enter promo code WSTPOD today. Karthik, let's talk about Wales-Belgium. We can for a second step away from the bravado of what Wales has done, and I actually want to ask you a little bit about the fact that we are going to be basically demolishing Belgium. I think all of us will be in our analysis. But for a minute, perhaps we should look at the starting lineup, the defense of that team. Meunier, Alderweireld, Dennerre, as well as Jordan Lukaku, who I think this was his first game of the tournament, Romelu Lukaku's younger brother. So when you look at that defensive line and you remember that they're missing Kompany and Vertonghen, etc., you have to, I guess there has to be some sympathy of what was a very, very inexperienced backline for Belgium.
Certainly there has to be, but Belgium's problem wasn't their back line. It was their midfield.
Hmm.
They were terrible in midfield. And the balance was never right in midfield. And I think, again, Mark Wilmot's got his tactics all wrong, his team sheet all wrong. The changes at the back were enforced changes. But the ability for Wales to control this game came from the midfield. It came from the play of Joe Ledley, Joe Allen, and especially Aaron Ramsey. And that had very little to do with the backline changes that Belgium were forced to make, the enforced changes, and obviously the pre-tournament injury to Kompany.
Right.
It had a lot more to do with starting Carrasco instead of Fellaini and then throwing Fellaini on for Carrasco when the game would have demanded a different sort of change. He went back to what he probably should have done at the beginning of the match. And then I think additionally, just not having the balance in that team right. The balance between where Hazard played and where and where De Bruyne played going forward. I just think the whole thing was a disaster in midfield. And you look at the I would say the only guy that showed consistent tactical discipline in that midfield was Axel Witsel, and he was just one midfielder of five. The other four guys were whoever were playing at the time were generally out of position throughout this entire tournament, not just in that game. So that's where I would lay the blame, not at the fact that they had all these changes on the back line. I do have some sympathy about that, but I don't think that made much of a difference in this match, quite honestly.
Chris, talk to me about that midfield then. Nainggolan scored an excellent goal, his second of the tournament. And at that point, it looked like Belgium had hit the ground running and was following up a good performance in the round of 16 with what would be a win against Wales. But Ashley Williams was left completely unmarked. And once that Wales goal went in, that midfield, as Karthik mentioned, looked absolutely at didn't look like a unit at all, did they?
No, they didn't. And this is what comes, I think, straight back to Mark Wilmot's desk. And I found it interesting that the Thibaut Courtois, who I consider to be quite a neutral character just in general, said that he voiced his thoughts to Wilmot in the dressing room, but he wouldn't disclose what they were, as if almost instantly also kind of disclosing what maybe he thought his opinion was in that moment. I think the thing with Wilmots is, and it was something that kind of circulated around social media for most of the aftermath of the game, is that he's quickly wasting what could be a golden generation for that country. And again, I've seen other comparisons to him being the Belgian Harry Redknapp, and the notion of him just kind of throwing 11 counters onto the tactics board and then telling them to go out in that formation. There is definitely a lack of organization for this team. And I think just in general, his tactical decisions are more than questionable. The fact that Kevin De Bruyne started this tournament out wide when he's very clearly Belgium's best number 10. Equally, his insistence with Marouane Fellaini, I'm certainly not looking to make Fellaini a scapegoat in this, as much to say that consistently, Wilmot has praised Fellaini, said there's no other player in the world like him. And it's just a very bizarre evaluation of a player who I don't think is anywhere near Belgium's most influential player across the board, never mind just in midfield. And we can certainly talk, and I think, you know, Kartik made some solid points there about the defence and the fact that maybe it's not the first choice. Of course it's not. I think that that is really where a coach earns his money in that sense, though. He forges a togetherness, a bunch amongst a group who maybe aren't the starters, the likes of Laurent Simon, Jordan Lukaku, Jason Denier, Denier in particular, I've been quite high on him going into this tournament and into this summer, because I think Pep Guardiola could do some good things with him. He was run ragged. He really was. He was, from what I saw watching it back, he was by far the worst Belgian defender, with Jordan Lukaku kind of following him closely behind. And I think it's just disappointment if you're a Belgian fan at this point, because you've lost a great opportunity against a side that I think is plucky and resolute as Wales were. They were also beatable. They have not been sensational themselves this tournament. They've been good in patches, but they've also been beatable.
Robert, with Wales, we have to obviously recognize that, as Karthik mentioned, that midfield did really well. And of course, there's certain Gareth Bale that we should talk about. But I have to wonder, a lot of us, a lot of people covering the Wales team have basically said that this has had to do with the brilliance of players and not given Coleman enough credit. So where do you fall on that spectrum? How much of what we saw were good tactics against a Belgium team that lost its structure? And how much is it the fact that these players really love playing with each other?
You know, that's an interesting question. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that this Wales team has talent, but isn't as deep as a Germany or Belgium, for that matter. These players coming off the bench necessarily aren't starting for the largest clubs in the world. So we're not talking about a team that has tons of depth going forward. So there's not much you can do, I would say, tactically, if you're going to. There's a drop with some of these players coming in and out. But there is something to be said for the rah-rah element. And I know more of the statistically inclined don't like that. But if you look at, to throw more dirt on Belgium, what Wilmot's biggest strength was. It was his ability to inspire his players. Coming into the tournament, that's what you heard, how much the players loved playing for him and so on and so forth, and how he could relate to them. And now all you're hearing is the stuff that's being said in the locker room and stuff coming out. So I think that Coleman, you know, there's so much been said about him and written about him and where his journey has come from, how he went from being almost fired to really taking Wales to where they are. And I think he's been able to build over time a cohesive unit. Part of that is tactics, finding the right tactical mix, the 3-5-2 look, who goes in where and what players play best in what position. I mean, heck, he found up the place where Aaron Ramsey should be playing, and for that reason alone, I'm willing to call him my favorite manager. But so part of it is bringing these players up together, finding where they play well, but also keeping this God, I'm going to sound so corny saying this Welsh spirit. This identity of this team, where you have a Gareth Bale, who's possibly the greatest player, one of the greatest players in the world, definitely, and these other players, and you don't. This isn't a team that looks like a Portugal, for example, where you have one of the greatest players in the world and then other players. This is a team that's a cohesive, that knows their roles, and gets behind it. And they're cocky. They're willing to poke their fingers in England's eye, for example, mm-hmm. but they're also a cohesive unit that plays well together. So part of it's tactics, but a lot of it is coming up together, this core unit that knows what they need to do when they're on the pitch. And I think Belgium can kind of look across the pitch and see that and wonder why they haven't been able to do that with a lot of similar advantages of players coming up through this system at the same time.
Yeah. Karthik, we've talked so much about Ramsey. And he will be missing in the semifinal against Portugal, along with Ben Davies. Portugal themselves will have Will Carvalho out, so there'll be a shuffle in that midfield. So give me your thoughts on the first semifinal of the European Championships.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult for Wales without Aaron Ramsey. The important thing for Chris Coleman this match is to figure out a way of playing with where Joe Allen and Joe Ledley remain in their current positions, which are not stationary positions, but they're not the most mobile positions. Mm. And they're positions where they've been able to kind of mop up and keep the shape while Ramsey has done spectacular things box to box and end to end. The work rate of Aaron Ramsey in this competition has been phenomenal. And then it allows you to continue to have a free role for Gareth Bale playing off whichever striker, whether it's Sam Vokes or Hal Robson-Connor, both of whom scored in this game. So obviously it's due to the tactical matchup. That'll depend on that, who Coleman starts up top. I think it'll probably be Robson-Connor. I think he might be a better matchup for Portugal, but I think that's the key. Not having mm-hmm. Ramsey is really going to hurt. I think Wales can still win. If they had Aaron Ramsey, they would win. So that's the way I'm looking at this game.
Chris, it looks like to me one of the things Wales has to do is play a deeper line than they have been playing in this tournament, because you cannot give Nani and Cristiano the ability to get past you, because any ball that's played through, no one on that Wales defense, including Neil Taylor, will be able to keep up with the pace of Nani and Cristiano.
Exactly. I think that's a fantastic point. The other thing you have to be very careful and wary of when you drop your line back a little bit like that is you have to shoot off the shooting lanes as well.
Yeah. And Renato Sanchez scored a goal from that area that would be of danger. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's those small combinations sort of inside the penalty box and those shots from 20, 25 yards. I think on a good day, tend to go high and wide and don't trouble you, but can also, it just takes one of them to fly in and really undo the Welsh plan. I think the thing for them is what I kind of have seen with them most of the tournament. It's going to be that quick break. The concerns, or one of the concerns I had for them pre-tournament, was would they have enough pacey outlets outside of Gareth Bale to link in those counter-attacking moments. Now, they have resoundingly proved me to be an idiot, because Hal Robson-Connor has been just that. I think if they can keep that fluency up, if they can just maintain their composure, because again, this is a new stage for a lot of these players. A lot of people will reduce this to Bale versus Ronaldo. Realistically, I think this is more about the supporting cast and those who don't get enough of the column inches to really shine, the likes of maybe Ashley Williams, Chris Gunn to come to the fore. Because I think if there's one thing you can say about this Portuguese side, it's that maybe there's not that great deal of strength in those fullbacks. They came into this tournament with Vieirinha, who is a former Porto winger, now turned fullback at Wolfsburg. Not the biggest, not the greatest in the air, I would argue. How can they maximise that to their advantage if he plays? Equally, Elisal, for my money, is not a traditional fullback. He's someone that is versatile. And I think when you have a player like that, it's always an opportunity to try and expose it. It's one of those things. I'll be curious to see how Chris Coleman lines up, because he has a few different options. And I think this is, in that sense, the biggest test for him as a manager in this tournament.
Robert, it's crazy, right? When we did the previews, it was Karthik, Chris, Gabe, and myself, and I talked about how I didn't rate Portugal's defense. Ironically, their defense has been just fine, except for that 3-3 game against Hungary. They've not really conceded many goals. It's been up top that they've had the problem. So in spite of mistakes that were made by Cedric Suarez, etc., the real issue, I guess, with Portugal is, are they going to be able to get past that Wales defense? Are they going to be able to get Cristiano on the ball? And when Cristiano gets on the ball, is it going to be Cristiano of 2 months ago or of right now? Because there seems to be a difference.
Yeah, and I think that's the scary thing if you're a Wales fan or someone pulling for them, is you're relying on a Cristiano Ronaldo to continue a form of play that hasn't been as stellar. I think if Wales's defense has proven to be, for the most part, good in this tournament, but Portugal has just done enough to get by, whether that's veteran ability or pure dumb luck. I don't know, probably a little bit of both. But I mean, this is a team that's scraped by enough to get through to this point in the tournament. And the fact that they could turn on some weapons or have some weapons turn on and cause some problems like a Ronaldo is a scary thing.
Karthik, let's talk about the other semifinal, and we'll start with reviewing the two games, which is Germany, Italy, and then France, Iceland from today. So Germany, Italy, Karthik, went to PKs. We know about PKs being a lottery, etc., but absolutely nail-biting stuff. Not a good advert for Premier League-based players, including Manchester United players. But let's talk about the start of the game. What I want to ask you is, the biggest news when the starting lineups came out was the fact that Germany seemingly switched to a 3-5-2. And beyond the fact that he went matched, that Jurgen Löw matched up Conte's system, I kept wondering if he played a bit of a psychological battle. He won a bit of a psychological battle as well, because we know Conte has been giving Italy, the Italian players, this idea of that of being underdogs, etc. And now when Germany, arguably one of the best teams in the world, switches their formation to match yours, all of a sudden, you don't; those players don't feel like underdogs anymore. So do you think that contributed to how this game played out?
Perhaps it did. I think Germany has a lot more talent. They have a lot more accomplished players, at least at the club level. And again, Italy, tactically, was quite good. Now, I have to say that there was some sloppiness passing out of the back in particular from mm-hmm. Italy, yeah. from that back three that we haven't seen at any other point in the tournament that we saw on Saturday. But I thought, again, Germany had a hard time breaking down a good tactical side. And they Jurgen Löw is getting all kinds of credit for this tactical piece, but what he's done is he's essentially put in place a similar tactical system to Conte with better players, and still it was a draw. They won on penalty kicks, but it was or advanced on penalty kicks. I'd like to point that out. They did not win. So I'm not sure that all the praise for Germany is warranted, although he found a way to get them through this match. Maybe if you play in that 4-2-3-1 formation that Germany's been playing with in this tournament and played for through much of the World Cup and the last Euros, actually, they've basically been playing that formation now for a while. You get beat by this Italian team, which has found a way to use the 3-5-2 to beat teams in that now conventional formation, right? The 4-2-3-1 mm-hmm. in this era is what the 4-4-2 used to be. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's worth noting. But I still give Italy a lot of credit, and I think Conte certainly was the most impressive manager in this tournament.
Chris, we got a little bit of a criticism on Twitter based on the fact that us as a podcast have not given Germany enough credit. So where do you stand on this German team based on the fact that even though we keep writing them off in terms of their performances haven't been that great, etc., here they are in the semifinal, and probably favorites to go and win the whole thing. So where do you stand on this German team?
I think they've shown adaptability. They came into this tournament really kind of lacking in fullbacks. I'm starting to think that might be a theme for the tournament, really. Not a wealth of quality fullbacks. and for me, you're right in that sense that they haven't always been scintillating. They maybe have not been as good as they were in the World Cup. The thing you can't really argue is they're getting the results. In the penalty shootout, for example, they showed the kind of cool mentality and the right kind of composure for that moment, which again is something I kind of grew up associating with Germany. Is you put them in a clutch situation like a penalty shootout, and there's a good chance you're going to lose against Germany. I think a lot of this team is in transition, though. The spine is very good. I think the spine of it has talent, definitely. The difficulty they had with Italy, I think, is they faced an exceptionally well-drilled team in Conte's side. And if you looked at the chalkboards, I kind of put them up on Twitter yesterday just to kind of appease Chelsea fans and keep them happy. Mesut Ozil, I don't think, registered a single pass into the penalty area, not a single pass into the six-yard box. Thomas Muller had a similarly frugal day in terms of what he could achieve and what he could create and do. And that goal aside, I didn't see a huge wealth of creation from Germany. On the one hand, yes, you can lament their attacking ability. I think you can also have an idea running alongside that that says that Italy were exceptionally good defensively. That's where I think this Germany team is, though, to answer the actual question, is they're a team transitioning into its next phase. And some of that will be awkward. Some of the games in that transition will be awkward. But I think what you can say is, as long as they're getting the results, they're moving towards the end goal that they want, which is to win this European Championship and build on the back of that World Cup success.
Robert, Italy is another team that's in transition. And as someone that supports the Italian national team and all things Italy, including pizza, we should talk to you about where you see this team going forward. Conte will leave. And I guess the big question for me is, where does Italy produce that next big striker? Because an argument can be made that had they had players better than Pelé and Eder, both are good players, but they're not at the levels of Roberto Baggio and players of that ilk. Had they had better finishers, had they had better forwards, Italy would have probably gone further in this tournament.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think it's unfortunate, understandable, but unfortunate that Conte is moving on, because he's been a real gift to Italian football, both at the club and at the national level. But the new manager that they have coming in is a gentleman who has spent a lot of time with some of the smaller teams, just coming off of Torino, I believe, most recently, Giampiero Ventura, who I think will bring a nice perspective to this club.
Would you say he's ace?
I'm sorry. Oh, jeez. Yes. Yes, yes. I would. Well, we'll find out if he's an ace. different kind of football, though. But I think for this team, you know, as long as you have the BBC line in the back, I think you're gonna have a strength in Italy. Obviously, that's aging. But the thing to also to remember about this Italian team is, in this match against Germany, they came in with probably their C midfield, if you think about it. A lot of their A midfield was hurt prior to this tournament, and then with De Rossi missing and Mota missing as well, I mean, there's probably a B lineup. So there's some talented Italian midfielders that are still out participating in World Cups and Euros, some younger players that are they're coming through. I think the big thing is, what's the next Italian identity? If a Buffon stays and this defense stays the same, is it this still the same style that can Ventura replicate this style that Conte kind of perfected in Italian club soccer? Or is it going to have to be a different style built on some of these younger, smaller, quicker strikers or someone, you know, maybe a little bit more experienced types? It'll be interesting. It's going to be in flux, but I do think that there is more talent coming through the Italian system than people will realize. It's just the names aren't as big as they had been 20 years ago.
But, I mean, you have to say the dance moves that Zaza showed were better than anything we've seen before in that PK. That's pretty...
The only person that might have worse... He might be the only person that has worse dance moves than I do.
Take your word for it. Karthik, let's talk about France, Iceland. Coming into this game, the story was always going to be, David Goliath. And sometimes, unfortunately, David loses to Goliath. And that's kind of what happened here, isn't it? With Iceland putting up a fight, but in general, France just had too much talent on the day.
Right. I mean, this time they were playing France. They weren't playing England. So that kind of
David versus David.
Right. I mean, it was David versus David in the last game, right? I mean, we have this perception that's created by media narratives that England is some great power in this sport, but they're not, okay? If you look at their body of work over the course of the last 3 years, there's very little to separate Iceland and England, whereas France is one of the giants in this sport, and they're hosting this tournament, and they're a team that hasn't really peaked yet. Well, maybe now they have peaked in this tournament, but they haven't peaked coming into this match. It was always going to be a dangerous one for Iceland, but they still acquitted themselves well. They still played some football. They kept the ball a little bit more, actually. Their passing was probably better today than it was against England, quite honestly. And obviously the game was stretched early on, so maybe it's not a fair comparison, but they were able to still score two goals, and I think gave us a great thrill in this tournament, and also saved all of us from enduring the 6 days of patriotic and jingoistic fervor that would have come with an England versus France game in a major tournament, mm-hmm. in the knockout stages of a major tournament. Can you imagine what the last 6 days would have been like before the inevitable England defeat to France by probably a similar scoreline to this? Maybe it wouldn't have been 5-2, it would have been 3-0 or 3-1, but we would have had 6 days of just absolute rubbish from our friends in the UK press, Chris's friends on Fleet Street, a lot of them. So we all owe Iceland a debt of gratitude, not only for the way they played football and the inspirational story, but for saving us from that fervor that comes in every major tournament where England makes a knockout stage, where those of us on this show and others who watch the sport a little more objectively know England is just going to end up losing whenever they play the first big power that they face in a knockout stage. And in this case, it would have been France. So Iceland saved us from that.
Chris, talk to me about some of the lessons that teams like the U.S. men's national team and England can learn from what Iceland has been able to do in the last 5 years. We're not even talking about a generation of footballers. In the last 5 years, the progress they've made. Can you opine on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think they can learn very different lessons. Some will overlap. I think the ones that overlap is you need a really recognized system that you can teach each player as a team, but then also on an individual level, so they know what they're doing relative to those around them. I haven't seen that with England in this tournament. I also haven't seen that with the US during Copa America. I've seen players that knew where to stand, but maybe not what to do. Mm. And that for me is quite a damning indictment on both coaches, one of whom is no longer in the job in question, in Roy Hodgson. I think for the US, what they can take from it is actually you do need infrastructure to help develop players. It's perhaps timely that there has been a lawsuit filed for these training compensation fees, mm-hmm. or whatever the correct term is. The US, for me, has to get a little bit more invested in that side of things in terms of developing. I'm not entirely convinced yet that Europe is the cure-all elixir for developing American players and that they need to be there. Certainly the ones who have plateaued in the US at the right age can benefit from going there and testing themselves, but it isn't for everybody. Landon Donovan kind of proves that. He's someone that the culture, the situation, the pressures, it just didn't work for him. And that will be the case for other players as well. And I fear that you set a dangerous precedent when you teach young players, both male and female, that if you can't make it in Europe, then you're not realizing your potential. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if that's necessarily untrue. In fact, I don't think there's a necessary way. I think it is plainly untrue.
Yeah, that's a good point. I can't help but also look at some of the things they've done with their coaching badges and the fact that they have one, I think the stat was one coach to every 700 players as opposed to 20,000 or something like that. I know that's a little bit difficult because Iceland's population is much less than England's and et cetera. But the fact that...
But this yeah. is... This has been a consistent problem for England since you address, bring this up. England, Iceland's is maybe an anomaly or outlier because they have such a small population. But if you compare the number of registered players to certified UEFA pro license holders and NA license holders in Spain, Germany, Holland, Belgium and France to England, the English number is really unflattering. So England is not developing enough coaches. Mm-hmm. Yeah, full stop. That has been a problem now for about a decade. So the Iceland one may be an extreme comparison, but actually you've hit on something really important to Poon, which maybe we can explore in another show, which is that England is developing roughly half or a third as many coaches per registered player as France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Spain, Italy. And that's a big, big problem.
Yeah, definitely worth talking about on another day. Robert, let's talk about France because we're not giving them enough credit. Some of the football they played in that first half was nothing short of magnificent. In particular, that Antoine Griezmann goal where Giroud just left the ball, played a dummy, and Griezmann went around the defender and played a delicious chip. Some of that football was absolutely brilliant, and it bodes well for the host, doesn't it?
You know, I think we saw, like you said, the best of France in this the beginning of this game. We saw, you know, some of the players that had been looking upon as some of the, you know, the talisman for this group play really well. I mean, when you have Giroud scoring goals and Griezmann scoring goals, seems to go really well for France. So I think that they were obviously the better team, as we mentioned, in this game. But I feel like they hadn't had that firing on full cylinders moment, to use an American cliche, that game where you just look at them and go, huh, you know, they could win this. And I think even though they were the better team that everybody knew going into this, this was kind of their moment, at least their half, where they showed that they're a dangerous team and to kind of help their fans feel a little bit more at ease. So whether that carries over into the next two matches, we'll see. Obviously a better opponent, but you've got to feel good about the fact that everybody came out healthy. Everybody came out in good form, and they're playing at home. So this is a much different France team than I think we saw two games ago.
Yeah, they'll have Conte back as well for the semifinal. Karthik, we got a question on Twitter, which leads into the preview from Mark Curlin, and he asks, can Germany contain a rampaging ascendant France?
It's going to be difficult for them. It'll be interesting to see if Germany goes back to a four-man back line with the four center backs or Kimmich at right back and let him bomb forward. He, by the way, has been one of the great revelations in European football. I neglected to mention him when we reviewed that game. So thank you for the question on Twitter. It gives me an opportunity to mention Kimmich, a player that Pep Guardiola seemed to have identified out of the number of guys from Bayern that were in their system, and a player he's very much molded into a Philipp Lahm-esque, not necessarily at the quality level of Philipp Lahm, but a Philipp Lahm-esque player in a really short period of time for both Bayern and now Germany. It could hold the key to this and could really transform Germany, because I don't think with their four-man fullback center back line, which got them through the World Cup somehow in Brazil, but they were playing a much weaker France team, right, in that quarterfinal. Mm-hmm. And Brazil wasn't very good. We know that. And they got them in the semifinal, and then somehow Higuain missed the chance in the final. So they got through it and they won the World Cup. But I think they're going to play a much more dynamic French side with better movement. I think France, despite Las Diarra and Benzema, three players I thought were going to be so key for them in this tournament, and it took them some time to adapt. They now have in N'Golo Kanté, a player, he didn't play today, obviously, but a player that's able to kind of tie together that midfield in a way he did for Leicester City also as they won the Premier League. And you've got then the ability for their other midfielders, Pogba and Payet in particular, or their other kind of attacking midfielders, if you will, to have a freer role. I know Deschamps says he wants Pogba to be more of a number six, but he can pop in there and play as a number eight. Well, I think he said he wanted him to be a number eight, right? Or did he say he wanted him to be a number six? But he can play as a number eight against Germany if you have four fullbacks and you have a kind of a less dynamic line. So that may be the key. I think Germany might stick with this 3-5-2 given the matchup, and then you have to account for Olivier Giroud's movement. He, for a number nine, is very mobile, and I think very, very good. His finishing obviously isn't so good, but the runs he makes and the space he creates and the target he provides on crosses and on set pieces is as good as anyone in this tournament. So Germany's going to have their hands full. Now, of course, going forward, Germany is going to put France under the gun, I think. France's back line, especially their older fullbacks, and we can talk about this when we preview the match further. I think their older fullbacks are going to have a hard time, Sané and Evra. I think this is going to be a bad matchup for them. But should be fun. Should be an exciting game.
Chris, Germany are going to be missing Sami Khedira, Gomez, Hummels. Schweinsteiger is almost certainly out at this point. So we're going to have to see some players coming in. Maybe Emre Can comes in. And I was wondering, kind of out of left field almost now, given how things have gone for him lately, maybe even bringing in Podolski for this game.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the thing. How adaptable are Germany? I think we're about to find out. This squad will be tested to its very limits. As you said there, Emre Can can come in. Potentially Podolski could come in. The feeling I have is that really as long as the spine sort of survives, I feel as if the animal will continue to breathe. Because again, they haven't been, as I said before, that blessed with wide options. You know, maybe this is an instance where they.
What about Draxler?
Yeah, Draxler's a funny one. I mean, there's a mystery wrapped in an enigma, in the sense that. You know, he's at Schalke and Arsene Wenger decides not to pay the money. Now, I'm not saying he is a de facto perfect talent spotter, but the fact that he didn't do that makes me think there's got to be some kind of concern in there. I do wonder if at this point, Yogi Löw is a little bit regretful over not bringing Marco Reus and giving him that opportunity. But again, this is so steeped in hindsight, you can barely see the surface. And I think for Germany, they've got the versatility. Having Mario Gomez out means that I believe Götze comes in and plays false nine. It's a position he's played before, so you're not necessarily rewriting the entire handbook at this point. You're just skipping to an earlier version of the software, to use some very really bad analogies.
Floppy disk. Let's talk about floppy disks and CD drives while we're at it. I actually agree with you because I think it was who was it on ESPN who was also suggested that it will be Götze and a false nine. Oh, it's Michael Ballack. Michael Ballack talked about the false nine, so maybe that's how they'll play. Podolski obviously has been out of the game for the most part, hasn't really played much in recent times. We know how things played out with him when he was alongside Giroud at Arsenal. So yeah, maybe that's a better shot. Gentlemen, what I want to do is go around and talk about who we would think will win these semifinals and then predict a final winner as well, because the next time we record, it'll be after the final. So Robert, let's start with you. The winners of the semifinal and your final winner for the European Championships.
You know, as much as I hate to say it, I think Portugal advances against Wales. I think losing Aaron Ramsey and Ben Davies is going to be a huge blow for them and their chances. I think they'll play the host nation. I think Germany overall is a probably more talented squad, but I think there's some questions there, and there's momentum does matter. So I think that you'll see France hoisting the trophy over a despondent Cristiano Ronaldo.
Karthik?
Yeah, I'm going to go with France to win this tournament. I think they win. They beat Germany, and then I think they beat. Would be an easy pick if Ramsey. The Davies, that's a good shout, Robert. Davies being out also matters, and I don't know if that means they. Neil Taylor's been so effective as a wing back. I don't know if they want to move him.
James Collins will probably.
I think James Collins. That's a rough one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess because of that, I'm going to have to pick. I don't know, actually. I want to pick Wales, but because I just Portugal hasn't shown that they can take advantage of any of these opportunities to win a game in 90 minutes. They still haven't won a game within 90 minutes. So yeah, why don't we pick Wales, and then I think Wales loses to France in the final. In the France Germany game, I think the weakness for France is Evra and Sanya. Potentially how they're able to cope with the movement of a Götze if he starts, a Draxler, the balls that Toni Kroos plays, and most especially Mesut Ozil. But the matchup going the other way, as I outlined a few minutes ago, I think heavily favors France. Yeah. And I think France is going to beat them, and it could be 2-0, or it could be one of those 1-0 games where Germany never really is in it. I just have a feeling France is beginning to peak. They're beginning to find their form, and it would be amazing if they won this tournament having omitted Benzema, having lost Diarra, who I thought was going to be the key for them in midfield prior to the tournament. They lost him in the last friendly, and Varane, who is their best defender. So they would have won this tournament without the spine of their team being there. I guess that's what home cooking does.
Chris?
I mean, I've gone against Wales for this entire tournament and consistently seemed like an idiot. The thing I have against it is Aaron Ramsey's absence just seems too great an obstacle to traverse. I mean, I'm well aware I'll never get a hotel room in Wales at this point if I keep it up. But I think Portugal advance forward. I think France. I actually think France could choke. I just have this feeling that it gets them. The pressure of 98 and reliving that moment, if you will, and Pogba trying to be like Zidane, who in fairness, you know, didn't have the greatest World Cup at that point. There's been a fair bit of revisionism about that, as often happens with beautiful stories that where the facts don't line up. I still think that Germany will take it though. And then in the final, I just think that Portugal will tank it again. I think there's just something in the water down there, as beautiful a country as it is, that stops them ever being true winners in that sense.
Let me just throw this out there before we say goodbye to everyone. Portugal has been this team that has been consistently underperforming in major tournaments. There's this side, and we're going back to even Euro 96 or Euro 2000, where they were very, very good. This team that has had at times some outstanding performances in group stage play, gotten out of the group, and they've had a stinker in the knockout stage. Would it be a nice kind of bow tie on everything if they somehow won this tournament after having drawn every game in the group stage, and then that's the way Portugal wins the major tournament, not the way they were rampaging in Euro 2008. Remember, they just ripped through the group stage and everyone thought they were going to win the tournament. It was a fait accompli. It was going to be them or the Dutch, and both teams choked in the quarterfinals. Or the way they looked in Euro 2012 when they lost in penalties, or Euro 2004 when they hosted and they were the best team and lost to Greece in that shocker. I mean, maybe this is the way they win a major tournament, when they've played poorly and no one's fancying them.
Karthik, you literally took away what I was going to say. For me, Portugal is going to win out. They're going to win the semifinal. Germany's going to beat France. I think France will choke. I think they peaked for this one game, but I think the likes of Boateng, who in spite of being throwing up his arms in the air for no reason, has been the defender of this tournament. And I think he will handle Giroud just okay. Germany will beat France to get to the final, but Portugal will beat Germany, thereby making it one of the, as we talk about revisionism, 10 years from now, we'll be talking about Cristiano's brilliant performance at the 2016 European Championships, because as Chris pointed out, people forget how poor Zidane was until the semifinal of the World Cup in 98. People will forget how poor Cristiano was, except for the Hungary game, until the semifinal and final of these European Championships. So Portugal will probably win. And we will be back on Sunday, a week from today, to discuss exactly how it played out and which one of us got those predictions right. So on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, on behalf of Chris Henaj, Robert Hay, and myself, Nipun Chopra, I wish you a happy July 4th. And Chris and Karthik,
enjoy your football.